This is Lecture 4 in the series A Theory of Productive Activity, Profit, and Saving. Let me begin by recapitulating some of the highlights of what I've discussed up to now. I began in my first lecture by describing the extent of the hostility to the economic activities of a capitalist society based on the charge that it doesn't represent genuine productive activity, that the only thing which is truly productive is manual labor. And the very next thing I did was to try to show that an essential ingredient of productive activity in the economic context of a division of labor society is the earning of money. And I extended that to show how, on this basis, we derive the concepts of productive expenditure and consumption expenditure, capital goods and consumer goods, producers' labor and consumers' labor. All of these concepts are going to be vitally necessary today and will play an extremely major role. In my second lecture, or even in the first, I believe, I explained while Adam Smith can be regarded as the father of what I consider sound ideas on the essential character of money-making in productive activity, he also had very horrendous ideas on the economic status of profits, interest, and land rent, viewing them as a deduction from what naturally and rightfully belonged to the wage earners, and that that framework was taken over by Marx. I then gave you a fairly extensive exposition of Marx's exploitation theory developed within that framework of the primacy of wages, that profits are a deduction from wages. And then on Saturday, I presented von Bavrick's critique of Marx. All right, well, today I want to begin by presenting a major portion of my own positive theory of profit, and then hopefully today proceed to apply it to a critique of the framework of the exploitation theory advanced by Adam Smith and Karl Marx. Now, let me try to explain what it is I want to explain and why. A positive theory of profit has a wider purpose than simply a critique of Karl Marx, although that's a pretty important purpose, but there are many other purposes. We want to have, know what determines the sum of all profits in the economic system. We want to be able to understand what determines the sum of all profits in the economic system, and on that basis, the average rate of profit. If we can figure out what determines the total of all profits, then all we have to do is divide by the total of all capitals, and we'll have the average rate of profit. If you've read The Government Against the Economy, you know that I spend a great deal of time talking about a tendency toward a uniform rate of profit prevailing among the different industries. Well, today we're out to explain what is it that determines the rate at which the different industries equalize. Why would it be 5% rather than 10%? Now, let me say further, if you've read Economics in One Lesson, the lesson, as Hazlitt repeats again and again, is that economics is the science which seeks to trace the effects of economic phenomena, not just on those directly concerned, but on all groups throughout the economic system, long run as well as short. And that is the reason why we want to know what determines the total of all profits in the economy. You might perhaps have the idea that this isn't necessary. You already know what determines profits. You'll make a good rate of profit if you invent a better product. Well, any individual company which can introduce a better product certainly will make a better rate of profit. But if we're thinking in terms of the effects on the whole economy, its competitors are not going to make a better rate of profit by virtue of its improvement. An improvement in products or methods of production raises the profits of those who introduce them and lowers the profits of those who have failed to introduce them. We are out to explain what determines the system-wide average rate of profit. And to do this, what we want to look at is the sum of all sales revenues in the economic system and subtract the sum of all costs deducted business by business from sales revenues, and that will equal the sum of all profits. We're going to try conceptually to embrace the functioning of the whole world economy. And this is going to be quite a feat of conceptualization. And let me tell you, as Dr. Peikoff pointed out in his discussion of objectivity and cognition, the answer cannot come to us directly. It's not going to be delivered to us. We're going to have to do some work to get it. We're going to have to adopt some provisional simplifications. We're dealing with an immense mass of concretes. The economic activities of tens of millions of business firms, hundreds of millions of buyers and sellers. We'll have to make a few provisional simplifications, each of which I will fully justify. All right, so our job is to explain the excess of sales revenues of all businesses in the economic system over the costs that they subtract from sales revenues. We want to explain aggregate profit. And I'm including in profit, as an aside, the interest that businesses pay. We want to explain profit and interest together. And one reason for that is we want to be in a position to deal with people like Marx and look at incomes other than wages in contrast to wages. We want to group them together, profit and interest. All right, well, if you have the handout in front of you, please open to pages 6 and 7. And let us focus on figure 1, which I've titled Net Consumption as the Source of Aggregate Profit. I don't expect you to have any idea at this moment what the expression net consumption means. I hope to make it clear within a few minutes. Now, I've broken figure 1 down into 2 columns. On the left, we have productive expenditure. Remember that discussion of productive expenditure? Buying for the expenditure made for the purpose of making subsequent sales. That's productive expenditure. And over on the right, we have sales revenues. Well, let us look for the moment on the left-hand side under the heading of productive expenditure, and let us focus on the item labeled 1, spending to buy capital goods. These are the goods purchased for the purpose of making subsequent sales. It embraces all of the materials business firms buy, all of the machinery and equipment, any good, and in fact, anything any business buys from another business. We would incorporate under this heading lighting and heating bills, advertising outlays, anything that business firms buy from other business firms, that is a capital good. And then right below that we have wage payments. And these are our 2 items of productive expenditure. Now, does anyone have any difficulty seeing a connection between productive expenditures and the costs that businesses deduct from sales revenues in their income statements? Where do costs come from? What do costs reflect? Productive expenditures. The costs represent the money that businesses have expended for the purpose of producing their products. Now, I am going to make an assumption for the purposes of simplification, which tomorrow or Saturday we can drop, but I'm going to make the assumption that productive expenditure and costs are equal. This will simplify our understanding, and I'll show that there is always a tendency for this equality. I don't think I should try to show why there's a tendency, because I'm sure many of you don't realize that there's any basis for a discrepancy. So, is there any trouble with taking productive expenditure and costs as synonymous. We'll take total productive spending in the whole system, and that will be the cost that businesses deduct from their sales revenues. All right, we have a connection between productive expenditure and costs. Productive expenditure and costs we're taking as equal. Now, let's establish a major connection between productive expenditure and sales revenues. Notice over on the left, on the right, I have as item one, receipts from the sale of capital goods. If we were doing a proof in geometry, this connection between item one on both sides would be a step like side equals side. If we were proving the equality of two triangles and we notice that they share a common side, we'd have side equals side. Well, productive expenditure to buy capital goods simultaneously by that very stroke represents sales revenues to the firm selling the capital goods. For example, when General Motors buys steel sheet from USX, as they call it now, General Motors' productive expenditure for steel sheet is simultaneously at that very moment sales revenues to USX. Anytime any business buys any capital good, its productive expenditure from its perspective and simultaneously at the very same moment sales revenues to the selling firms. So in the economy as a whole, we have one huge chunk of productive expenditure is equal by identity to one huge chunk of sales revenue. All right, now what about wage payments? I'm going to assume, and again with justification, and this is something we'll relax or can relax later, that all of the wages business firms pay come back to business firms in the form of receipts from the sale of consumers' goods. The business firms pay the workers their wages, and then the workers spend the wages in buying consumers' goods. Now, I think that for the most part, this is obviously true. You might say, yeah, okay, I can imagine the wage earners consume 80%, 85, 90% of their wages, and that's spending for consumer goods. But I would go even further and say that a major chunk of what wage earners save also shows up as a demand for consumer goods. For example, most wage earners put their savings into savings and loan associations, savings banks, life insurance policies. Well, what do these institutions do with the savings? A major chunk of those savings are lent to people to buy houses, to buy automobiles and refrigerators and take vacations and so forth on credit. Well, this represents a demand for consumer goods. The savings that finance the purchase of homes, automobiles, appliances for personal use represent a financing of consumption expenditure. Now, it is also true that some part of the savings of wage earners may be used to purchase stock in corporations to start their own business enterprises. That's perfectly correct. But by the same token, business firms are also advancing funds for the financing of consumer loans. For instance, a corporation might buy paper issued by General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is then used to finance automobile installment loans. So I want to make you aware that it is not at all unreasonable, as a fairly close approximation at least, to assume that what is paid out in wages comes back as a demand for consumers' goods. So we've got the totality of productive expenditure on the one side showing up as the costs of business firms in the entire economy and as generating an equivalent amount of sales revenues. Well, where do we stand thus far as profit goes? We have no profit. We have sales revenues equal to productive expenditure and costs equal to productive expenditure. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. If sales and costs are the same, there's no profit. Well, what does that tell us? It tells us that if we want to explain profit, we have to look for sources of sales revenue that do not represent productive expenditure and do not originate in productive expenditure. We have to look for sources of sales revenue that do not represent productive expenditure and do not originate in productive expenditure. There are such sales revenues, and let me right away give you the leading, most important varieties. There is the consumption expenditure of the businessmen and capitalists themselves. Businessmen and capitalists do not exclusively make productive expenditures. They're also living human beings who make consumption expenditures. And the source of the consumption expenditures of businessmen and capitalists, in the case of corporations, would be dividend payments. In the case of partnerships and proprietorships, partners and proprietors regularly draw funds from their firms to support their personal expenditures. Now, to whatever extent dividends, the draw of funds by partners and proprietors, are consumed, we have sales revenues, but we do not have any counterpart in productive expenditure or costs. The payment of a dividend is not a productive expenditure. It's a transfer of funds from an enterprise to its owners. There's not an exchange. There's not a, you don't find a cost deducted from sales, the dividends paid. That's not a cost. The draw of funds by partners and proprietors is not a cost. But the expenditure of these funds is sales revenues. Well, if we think about this, we have an explanation of an excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure. In total, business is paying out productive expenditure, and then over and above productive expenditure, it pays dividends, and partners and proprietors draw funds. Sales revenues reflect the sum of productive expenditure plus the consumption of the owners of business. And sales revenues exceed productive expenditure by the consumption of the businessmen and capitalists themselves. And if productive expenditure is equal to costs, then this excess of sales revenue over productive expenditure is the excess of sales revenue over costs. Now, at this point, I fear to tread because there is a wrinkle which I want to mention. If it gives you any trouble, I'll tell you how to cope with it. Because we want to view profits as gross of interest, we want to look at profits prior to deduction of interest cost, we also should include consumption out of interest payments as a source of sales revenues that don't have a counterpart in costs. Why don't they have a counterpart in costs? Well, we're not counting those costs. We're viewing profit pre-deduction of interest, yet interest exists, it is paid, consumption takes place out of it. The consumption out of interest payments helps to make sales revenues greater than all the costs other than interest. Now, if that gives you a problem, don't get bogged down in it. Proceed as though none of the capital is borrowed, all of it is owned by the stockholders. We don't want to get hung up on this technicality. The essential point is sales revenues exceed productive expenditure by virtue of the consumption expenditure of the businessmen and capitalists. And if you look at figure one, give this some attention, you might make a little note, put a circle around items one and two under productive expenditure, the spending to buy capital goods and the wage payments, and that is costs. The total of those two together represents costs. Now, look over on the right-hand side, sales revenues, and ask yourself, by what do sales revenues exceed those costs? Item one counts in both by identity. Where is the excess of sales revenues over costs? Item three, the receipts from the sale of consumers' goods to the owners, and I say also the creditors. It's the businessmen and capitalists, whether they're owners or creditors. Now, notice, I want to call your attention to a slightly different way of looking at the same facts. On the right-hand side, if we add items 2 and 3 together, what do we have? We have total consumer spending. We have consumer spending from the wage earners and consumer spending from the businessmen and capitalists. That's the total consumer spending. All right, looking at it that way, what is the source of profit? Could we say it's consumption minus wages? Isn't it items 2 and 3 on the right minus item 2 on the left? Does anyone have trouble seeing this? That the source of the excess of sales over productive expenditure is the sum of items 2 and 3 on the right minus item 2 on the left. It's consumption minus wages. Why is that? Well, we have wage payments, and how do wage payments enter into consumption? They enter in equivalently. Well, item 3, receipts from the sale of consumers' goods to businessmen and capitalists, is equal to consumption minus wages. And that's what I call net consumption. Net consumption is consumption minus wages. The essential component of net consumption is the consumption of businessmen and capitalists. That's what makes it possible, mainly, for consumption to exceed wages. The wage earners consume their wages, and then there are other consumers. There's the businessmen and capitalists who also consume, and that makes consumption exceed wages. We add spending for capital goods to consumption. We have total sales revenues. We add spending for capital goods to wages. We have productive expenditure. Sales minus productive expenditure comes down to consumption minus wages. Why does sales minus productive expenditure equal consumption minus wages? Well, one part of sales is sales from capital goods, item 1. One part of productive expenditure is the purchase of capital goods, item 1 on the left. So what does sales minus productive expenditure reduce to? Consumption minus wages. Sales are sales from consumer goods plus sales from capital goods. Productive expenditure is spending to buy capital goods and wage payments. Capital goods figure in both, in sales and productive expenditure. If we take productive spending away from sales, capital goods cancel in both. We're left with consumption minus wages. And the main thing that makes that possible, as I say, is the consumption of businessmen and capitalists. Now let's take an arithmetical example to try to concretize this and cement your understanding. If you look down on page 7, I ask you to make the following assumptions. Assume that spending to buy capital goods equals 500 units of money. And a unit might be $10 billion. We don't have to be concerned with the precise size of the unit. We want to limit the number of zeros, though. So imagine spending to buy capital goods is 500 units of money. Wage payments equal 300 units of money, and the wage earner's consumption also equals 300 units of money. Consumption spending out of dividends, draw, and interest equals 200 units of money. Then I say, now find 1, total productive expenditure. You can use the figure 1 as a guide. You could pencil in the spending to buy capital goods. That's 500. Wage payments, 300. What's total productive expenditure? 800. All right. What is total sales revenues from all sources? Total receipts from the sale both of consumers' goods and capital goods. 1,000. There's the 500 spending to buy capital goods. That shows up on the right. There's the 300 consumption of the wage earners, and then, in addition, there's the 200 consumption of the businessmen and capitalists. Well, now a monumental arithmetical problem. Find the excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure. 200. Now tell me aggregate profit on the assumption that productive expenditure and aggregate costs are equal. $200. And finally, net consumption, consumption spending minus wages. Well, what is consumption spending altogether? What's consumption spending? $500, and wages are $300, so what is net consumption? $200. Okay, well, this is a quantitative illustration. You can work this a few times at your leisure. Now I'd like you to make a change in the assumption, in the numerical assumptions we've just made. As we read down the page, I say change the assumptions of the previous example so that wage payments and the wage earner's consumption fall from 300 to 200 units of money. We're going to reduce wages and the wage earner's consumption. In addition, the demand for capital goods falls from 500 to 400 units of money. These are the results of a rise in the consumption of the owners and creditors of business firms from 200 to 400 units of money. Now, to make this a little bit concrete, you might wonder, okay, well, how could such a thing happen? Let's try to take a couple of concrete examples and generalize from it. Suppose the owner of a business firm decides, he reads the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and he decides, I want to live it up more, enjoy my life a lot more in the present. Instead of buying that new tractor-trailer truck I was contemplating, I'm going to buy a yacht. I'm going to consume this money instead of using it in my business firm. Instead of using the money I have been to meet my payrolls, I'm going to consume those funds too. Maybe I'll hire a butler and maid and so on and on, or I'll use it to buy other consumer goods. All right, now project this happening on a large scale throughout the economy. For whatever reason, businessmen and capitalists decide they want to live it up a lot more, and the consequence is productive expenditure is reduced, their personal consumption expenditure is correspondingly enlarged. And with these numbers. So their personal consumption expenditure is going to be 400. Productive expenditure in paying wages is cut from 300 to 200, and in buying capital goods from 500 to 400. All right, well, now again, I ask you, find total productive expenditure. 600, no longer 800. Find total sales revenues in the economic system. What are total sales revenues? Still 1,000. The excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure. 400. And if productive expenditure equals costs, what is aggregate profit? 400. And what is net consumption? What's the excess of consumption over wages? Well, what are wages? 200. What's the consumption of the wage earners? 200. What's the consumption of the owners of business? 400. What's total consumption? 600. What's 600 minus 200? 400. Okay. So now we have a higher amount of profit corresponding to a higher amount of net consumption. Now I'm just going to ask you to carry the same procedure to a much higher degree. On page 8, I say, continuing to assume that productive expenditure and costs are equal, find sales revenues and profit in the economy if total productive expenditure falls to 100, to 10, to 1, to 0, while the consumption expenditure of the owners and creditors of business rises to 900, 990, 999, 1,000. And now I give you a column of answers. What have we got? If productive expenditure is 100, whether it's paid as wages that are consumed or to buy capital goods, and the consumption of the owners and creditors of business is 900, well, what's total sales revenues? 1,000, what's total cost? 100, what's total profit? 900. Now, if we carry this further, productive spending falls to 10, the consumption of the owners and creditors of business rise to 990, what's sales revenues? Still 1,000, but now what's costs? 10, what's profit? All right, I don't have to go through every step. Obviously, it'll be 999 for profit if net consumption is 999. And now suppose there's no productive expenditure at all. All the sellers of products take the sales proceeds and simply consume them. They make no productive expenditure of any kind. Everybody is just a consumer. Well, what are the sales revenues if now we have 1,000 of consumption by the owners of businesses, zero productive expenditure? What are sales revenues? 1,000, what are costs? Zero. Okay, now up to this point, maybe this has seemed like a rather purposeless exercise. Let's cash in on it. This is a description of Adam Smith's Early and Rude State of Affairs and Karl Marx's CMC sequence, only the interpretation is the exact opposite. If we have a situation in which we had manual laborers producing and selling products, and no one is acting as a capitalist, no one is buying for the sake of subsequently selling, there is no capitalistic circulation. There's people simply producing commodities which they sell for money, and then they turn around and they spend the money to buy other commodities, not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. We have sales revenues. Do we have any productive expenditure? No. Do we have any cost to deduct from the sales revenues? No. Do we have any wages paid to produce these products that are being sold? No, we don't. Well, if we have sales revenues and zero costs, what is the nature of the income that's being earned? It's all profit. In Adam Smith's Early and Rude State of Affairs, it's not the case at all that the wage earners receive all the income, nothing goes to profit. In that state of affairs, everything is profit. In Marx's CMC sequence, CMC, this is not the case that here everything is wages, nothing is profit. This is all profit. Insert a first M equal to zero. Profit is the original primary form of income. Now then, when businessmen and capitalists appear on the scene, then productive expenditure comes into existence. Then wage payments come into existence. As a consequence of productive expenditure, costs of production in terms of money come into existence. What is the effect of that on profits as a percentage of sales revenues? It reduces it from 100% to something less. Those of you who were here at our last conference, you may remember, or who heard the tapes, my discussion of real wages and the economic degree of capitalism. Well, the higher the economic degree of capitalism, the more the buying for the sake of selling, the more the productive expenditure relative to sales. In that case, the larger will wages be relative to sales, the smaller will profit be relative to sales. The truth is, businessmen and capitalists do not come and subtract profits and interest from what was originally all wages. Originally, everything is all profit. Businessmen and capitalists create productive expenditure, wages, and costs of production, which are then a subtraction from sales revenues, all of which was originally profit. It's the exact opposite of the framework of the exploitation theory. Profit, not wages, is the original primary form of income. Now, the producers in a pre-capitalist economy earn profit, and incidentally, I should point out, the rate of profit in such conditions is infinite. We have profit equal to whatever the sales revenue are, the sales revenues are. What is the capital invested in terms of money? There's no capital in terms of money. No one has bought anything for the purpose of selling. The monetary value of capital invested is absolutely zero. If we divide any positive amount of profit by zero, what's the rate that we get? Infinite. So in the early and rude state of society and pre-capitalist circulation, all income is profit, however meager that income may be, and the rate of profit is infinite. And then in degree that we achieve the existence of capitalists who are there making productive expenditure, capital comes into existence, productive expenditure, wages and costs, and the rate of profit is lower. Now, I note down at the toward the middle of page 8 something I want to make you aware of. The theory of profit as I presented it up to this point is not yet complete. It's far from complete. There's a tendency for costs deducted from sales revenues to equal productive expenditure, but we'll see in later discussion, in any given period of time, the two do not in fact have to be equal. And we'll see that there is a further determinant of profit reflecting this difference, which I'll call net investment. I just want to make you aware that there's more to the full story than I've been able to indicate up to the present moment. So we're not yet finished. But I think we've said enough to establish that the whole conceptual structure of the exploitation theory is upside down. If you think about it, it is ludicrous to think that profits are a deduction from wages. Wages are a cost. Costs are deducted from sales revenues. And if there is no spending for the purpose of making the sales revenues, there's no cost in terms of money. It's all profit. All right, well, as I say, the primitive producers in a pre-capitalist economy were profit earners, not wage earners. In order for people to live as wage earners, there have to be capitalists. Wages are paid by the capitalists out of capital, not by the consumers in buying the product. Now let us turn to the conditions of a modern economy, and let us see who the producers are here. And I will say that the fundamental primary producers continue to be profit earners, not wage earners. Now let me come at it this way. The standard that I'm using for who is responsible for production is who supplies the guiding, directing intelligence. Who supplies the guiding, directing intelligence? Von Mises has a statement somewhere to the effect that it is not toiling which produces the products, but toiling directed by reason. It's the element of whoever provides the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level, they are the primary producers of the products. And let me give you some examples from fields outside of economics. Let's take the discovery of America. Now, who do we normally say discovered America? We say Columbus discovered America. Do we say it was Jose and Pedro who were manning hoisting the sails on the Santa Maria? Did they discover America? Now, they played a role. They helped Columbus to discover America. But we attribute the primary credit to Columbus. Why? He supplied the guiding, directing intelligence. He initiated the project and conducted it. If we take another example. Suppose we talk about military history. We would say Napoleon won the Battle of Austerlitz. Do we say it was Jean-Paul and Pierre and so on who won the Battle of Austerlitz? The soldiers? Now, they helped. They played a role, but we give the credit for Napoleon by the standard that he supplied the guiding, directing intelligence. If we talk about the foreign policy of the United States, we would talk of the foreign policy of the president, not the foreign policy of the embassy employees. Well, The same standard, if we apply it to production, means that we should say the product of the old Ford Motor Company or the old Standard Oil Company should be attributed to Ford and Rockefeller. They are the ones who supply the guiding, directing intelligence. And the employees, as the common expression from everyday language describes it, are the help. But the product is the product of the businessmen and the capitalists. And this leads to a radical reinterpretation of the doctrine of labor's right to the whole produce. This right is satisfied every day when Ford and Rockefeller and their counterparts keep their produce or the full value of the produce. They get the sales proceeds, it belongs to them. That's the satisfaction of labor's right to the full produce. It's a question of who's the labor? Well, it's the businessmen and capitalists. They are the producers at the highest level. Now, we might raise the question, well, what about passive capitalists? Let's say people who own stock or bonds, they take no active role in the conduct of a business firm, but they receive dividends or interest. All right, for 1 minute, let us imagine that they were receiving an unearned income that represented an exploitation of labor. Who is the labor being exploited? Who pays the incomes? Is it the men on Ford's assembly line who pay the interest to his passive stock, passive bondholders and dividends to his passive stockholders, or does he pay it? He pays it. Who comprises the passive capitalists? I would say, to a large degree, widows and orphans. Well, if we wanted to say that the payment of dividends and interest represents an exploitation, that would mean that it's widows and orphans exploiting Ford and Rockefeller. Now, let me hasten to point out that there is no exploitation here. In fact, Ford and Rockefeller gain by borrowing money. They're using it to carry on operations on a larger scale, to make a profit greater than the interest that they have to pay or the dividends they have to share. So both parties gain. There is not an exploitation. Let me also point out that dividend and interest income can be very fully earned as a result of your own personal labor. Anyone who attempts to play the stock market should realize that there's no limit to the amount of labor and effort and thinking that you can put in to tracking the different companies, and to the extent that you do that, whatever you make, you have earned. So even the incomes of the so-called passive capitalists can, in fact, and very, very, very often usually are earned. In a capitalist society, those who were truly not capable of following stocks or evaluating their securities would have to turn them over to trustees if they didn't want to lose their capital very quickly. The rate of return they would obtain would be extremely low and most likely not enough to cover the rate at which they consumed. Imagine we have someone who inherits $20 million. He's not capable of managing it efficiently himself. He's wise enough to turn it over to a trustee, and perhaps he makes then a 2% annual rate of return after trustees' fees. Well, the odds are he'll probably be consuming at 3 or 4%, and there's a tendency for inherited fortunes where the heirs lack the talent to really run it, for those fortunes to shrink, or as a minimum, not to keep pace with the growth of other people's capital. So they become a continually diminishing element in the economic system. All right, I have tried to establish profits as a labor income, an income due to the labor of businessmen and capitalists, just as in a pre-capitalist economy, profits exist and are due to manual labor. In a capitalist economy, the kind of labor that the capitalists are performing is intellectual labor, predominantly and overwhelmingly. Not exclusively, but overwhelmingly. And that introduces an important factor. That is what explains why the incomes of capitalists tend to vary with the size of their capital. A capitalist who has a capital that's 10 times larger than another capitalist, other things equal, will tend to make 10 times the profit. That doesn't mean that his income is any less the product of his own labor. It's just that he has 10 times the means with which to implement his ideas. Imagine we have two capitalists. One of them owns one store, another owns 10 stores. Each of them gets an idea as to how to improve the operation of his store. Well, the one who owns the 10 stores can apply his idea on a 10 times larger scale. It shouldn't be shocking that with the same labor, he's able to make 10 times the income, but it's still due to his labor. Now, I make this point because very early on, Adam Smith considered the question of whether or not profits could be an income due to labor, the labor of businessmen. And let me quote him on this point. He says, "The profits of stock, it may perhaps be thought, are only a different name for the wages of a particular sort of labor, the labor of inspection and direction. They are, however, altogether different, are regulated by quite sufficient principles, and bear no proportion to the quantity, the hardship, or the ingenuity of this supposed labor of inspection and direction. They are regulated altogether by the value of the stock employed, and are greater or smaller in proportion to the extent of this stock. Let us suppose, for example, that in some particular place where the common annual profits of manufacturing stock are 10%, there are two different manufacturers, in each of which 20 workmen are employed at the rate of £15 a year each, or at the expense of £300 a year in each manufactory. Let us suppose, too, that the coarse materials annually wrought up in the one cost only £700, while the finer materials in the other cost £7,000. The capital annually employed in the one, in this case, amounts to only £1,000, whereas that employed in the other will amount to £7,300. At the rate of 10%, therefore, the undertaker of the one will expect a yearly profit of about £100 only, while that of the other will expect about £730. But though their profits are so very different, their labor of inspection and direction may be either altogether or very nearly the same." So he assumes that because two businessmen might provide equal, what he calls labor of inspection and direction, it's wider than that, of course, but because the labor is equal and the results are unequal, because the results vary with the capital, that therefore you have to attribute the result to the capital, not to the labor of the businessman. He's at least not a Marxist, but he's denying that businessmen are responsible for their own profits. Well, let me point out that we are still fully justified in attributing results to the guiding, directing intelligence, irrespective of the quantity and efficacy of the means employed. The result still goes to the guiding, directing intelligence. It's still attributed to the guiding, directing intelligence, even though the same guiding, directing intelligence may produce very unequal results with different means employed. If that were not the standard, we couldn't attribute anything to human labor. Suppose we take two workers digging holes. One of them is using a hand shovel. The other is using a steam shovel. The one with the steam shovel will obviously dig a much bigger hole. But do we say that the only thing produced by labor is what the man with the hand shovel digs, and that the rest is produced by the steam shovel? Now, if you say that, then let's compare the man with a hand shovel with someone with no shovel, scratching with his fingers and nails. What does labor produce? When a worker uses a shovel, does he dig a hole, or does the shovel dig the hole? He digs the hole. It's the guiding, directing intelligence that produces the product. If that's not the standard, then labor doesn't produce anything. The way that labor produces is by supplying the guiding, directing intelligence. And in fact, we could parody Smith's passage. Let me read you my parody of it. The holes that are dug, it may perhaps be thought, are only a different name for the products of a particular sort of labor, the labor of digging. They are, however, altogether different, are regulated by quite sufficient principles, and bear no proportion to the quantity, the hardship, or the ingenuity of this supposed labor of digging. They are regulated altogether by the means employed for digging, and are greater or smaller in proportion to the extent of those means. Let us suppose, for example, that in some particular place there are two different men, one of whom sets about digging with his bare hands, the other of whom employs a shovel. The one will expect a hole of only very small dimensions, while the other will expect a hole of much larger dimensions. But though the holes that are dug are very different, their labor of digging may be either altogether or very nearly the same. Well, it's the exact same point. The attribution of a result to labor is independent of the size and efficacy of the means employed. The variation of profits with capital does not in any way contradict the fact that they are the result of the intellectual labor of the businessmen and capitalists. Those who have more capital are able to apply their ideas on a broader scale. Nor does the variation of profit with the passage of time contradict their attribution to the intellectual labor of businessmen and capitalists. If you're going to invest money for 2 years and there's a certain rate of return you can make in 1 year, well, to invest for 2 years, you have to make that return twice, allowing for compounding. Competitive conditions require it. Now, notice competition, all kinds of things can influence the incomes that people make. Why is it that watchmakers make a higher income than bricklayers? Does competition have anything to do with this? Does the supply of the two different types of labor have anything to do with it? It certainly does. But would we say on those grounds that there are factors influencing the size of the incomes of different wage earners that therefore the wage earners haven't earned their income? The fact that the income of wage earners may vary with the scarcity of their skills, does that mean that their incomes are less earned? No, because the standard is they're providing the intellectual effort. They provide guiding, directing intelligence at their level. That's the basis on which they earn their income. You can have incomes varying with all kinds of things, but the thing to which it is to be attributed is the human intelligence that is applied to earn that income, the purposeful human intelligence. All right, well, let us try to consider more precisely the positive productive function of businessmen and capitalists. The way I describe it, I say to raise the productivity and remuneration of manual labor by creating and coordinating the division of labor and improving the efficiency of production under it. What businessmen and capitalists are doing is creating division of labor, coordinating division of labor, and improving the efficiency of production under it. Now, a lot of you, or probably almost all of you, won't fully be able to appreciate this because in this series of lectures, I have not been able to give you a discussion of the division of labor and its importance. I did it 4 years ago, and I'm sure that almost everyone who heard that lecture has certainly forgotten almost all of it. So I'm not able to impress upon you sufficiently the importance of the division of labor. I will simply have to assert that the division of labor is an indispensable precondition for a high and rising productivity of labor. The division of labor makes possible a radical multiplication of the amount of knowledge employed in production. Each specialized branch of the division of labor has its own specialized body of knowledge. In a non-division of labor society, all the producers know essentially the same thing. The sum of knowledge is limited to what the minds of one person or one family can hold. In a division of labor society, the total body of knowledge that goes into production is multiplied by all of the different distinct specializations. It's elevated to a standard set by geniuses. In a division of labor society, geniuses don't spend their lives growing turnips for themselves. They can concentrate on science, invention, philosophy, etc. There are all kinds of further advantages. I'll just have to hope that you can have some grasp that the division of labor is absolutely vital to a high and rising productivity of labor. And it's the division of labor about which the specific productive functions of businessmen and capitalists center. They create division of labor, first of all, in establishing and organizing business enterprises. If you think about it, each business enterprise is specialized. There's no business enterprise that produces everything. Each business enterprise produces a fairly limited range of products. So there is division of labor among the different business enterprises. We have business firms that are mainly in automobiles, others that are growing cotton, on and on. Within each business enterprise, there's an internal division of labor. There are departments, sections. Each worker has a fairly specific job. There are many specialized categories of work within each firm. Well, business firms are the central units of a division of labor economy, as between the different enterprises and within the different enterprises. And businessmen, in founding and organizing business firms, are creating the central units of a division of labor society. They also create division of labor, and make division of labor possible in the provision of capital. Now let us imagine that there were no capital in the sense of money being spent for the purpose of making subsequent sales. There was no buying for the sake of subsequently selling. So if you were a producer, if you were physically making anything, the only party that you could hope to sell it to would be the ultimate final consumer. Now imagine you're an automobile worker. When would you be paid for the work that you were doing on a particular car? When it sold, if the buyer could afford to pay for it when he bought it. But what about all the buyers who can only buy a car on a 3 or 4 year installment loan? Well, you'd have to wait 3 or 4 years before you could be fully paid for your work in producing the automobile. What if you're producing steel? Well, then you have to wait that long, the steel that goes into the automobile, you'd have to wait that long, plus the time between the completion of your work and your work reaching the auto plant. If you're an iron miner, still more. What if you're building a factory? How long would you have to wait till you were fully paid? Till the factory went out of existence. If it were producing consumer goods, till the last consumer goods were paid for. What if you're helping to build a factory which is producing machines for the construction of further factories? Well, you might not be paid in your lifetime. The provision of capital introduces a kind of division of payments. We don't have to wait for the ultimate final consumer. Everybody can be paid within a reasonable period of time of the completion of his work. Without this, we could not have any extensive vertical division of labor. We couldn't have a division of labor in the sense of one operation succeeding another. We couldn't have any extensive vertical division of labor. So the formation of capital, the advancing of funds for the purpose of making subsequent sales, underlies the vertical division of labor. It also underlies the division of labor in what you could call the horizontal scale, too. Suppose we want a particular job, a particular step in the production of a product, to be able to be someone's full-time job. Let's imagine we want to make it possible for attaching the left rear tire of an automobile in an auto factory to be a full-time job. We might then be able to adopt a special tool that just keeps pushing such a tire on to the car. Well, would it be possible to have this as someone's full-time job or to adopt a special tool for it if we had an auto factory where we were turning out 5 cars a day. What kind of volume of production is needed to make small steps a full-time job and to allow for the adoption of specialized equipment? You need a large volume of production. Well, you need large-scale production, which depends on large-scale capital investment to make possible most of the horizontal division of labor as well. All right, well, I'm saying businessmen and capitalists create division of labor by founding and organizing business firms and by providing capital to them. They also coordinate the division of labor, and this in a twofold way. Internally, there is management. Has anyone ever stopped to think why such a thing as management is necessary? What is management managing? It's the division of labor. The management of a firm is coordinating the division of labor within the firm. Now, businessmen and capitalists coordinate the division of labor on a bigger scale than that. On the one side, they're the top managers within their firms, but they also coordinate the individual firms in relation to the rest of the economic system. And here, the discussion I had in The Government Against the Economy about the uniformity of profit principle applies. The fact of being interested in making a higher rate of profit rather than a lower rate and in not wanting to make losses leads businessmen and capitalists to see to it that their firms, that they try to get into lines that aren't being carried far enough and get out of lines that are being carried too far. And they're led to do that just by trying to make a higher rate of profit rather than a lower rate. For elaboration, see Chapter 1 of The Government Against the Economy. So this is the coordinating function they employ within the context of a division of labor society. Now also, they are responsible for constantly raising the efficiency of production within the division of labor. How do you make a high rate of profit, which is what they want to do? Well, as I explained in The Government Against the Economy, you have to introduce some improvement in production, a better product or a less expensive way of making an equally good product. And then competition will eliminate that special profit. The full benefit sooner or later gets passed on to the buyers. Then you have to make further improvements. Well, think about this for a moment. The quest for an exceptional rate of profit, first of all, led people to start selling automobiles, then to put self-starters on them, automatic transmission, one thing after another. This is raising the efficiency of production within the system. And then the efficiency of production is raised in a further way through the provision of capital. This anticipates discussion of saving in buying capital goods rather than consumer goods. The fact that there are capitalists who save and make funds available to buy capital goods, who choose to do that rather than consume, that brings about the production of the capital goods. If General Motors is faced with a heavier demand for trucks and diesel locomotives rather than passenger automobiles because people are saving more heavily, then it devotes more of its effort to producing trucks and diesel locomotives rather than passenger automobiles. That then makes possible a higher level of production in the future. So in providing capital, businessmen are acting to raise the productivity of labor. There is a lot more that could be said about that. I go into it more fully in lectures 4 through 6 from last time on that tape series, Introduction to Pro-Capitalist Macroeconomics. Let me say right here that within certain limits, you can reconcile the productive role of businessmen and capitalists that I've been describing with the labor theory of value, provided we don't understand it as Marx did with his absurd exaggeration, but understand it with all of the qualifications of the classical economists. The businessmen and capitalists are responsible for constantly reducing the quantity of labor required to produce goods and constantly improving the types of goods that manual labor can produce. And on that basis, they're responsible for the constant rise in real wages. They're responsible for two things. They're responsible for the supply of goods being offered in the market, steadily improving in quantity and quality, and for the very existence of wages in production. The more the businessmen and capitalists, the greater the capital devoted to production, the greater is the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumer goods. The higher the so-called wage share of total consumption. And at the same time, the higher and more progressively rising the productivity of labor, and that operates continuously to reduce prices relative to wages. Businessmen and capitalists are the parties, along with scientists and inventors, whose activities they stimulate and seek out, who are responsible for raising the productivity of manual labor and real wages. And the labor theory of value is consistent with that. You see, we have to ask the question, well, why is it in our economy 1 hour of labor is capable of turning out 10,000 units of some product rather than two? Why is it that an hour of labor in our economy is capable of turning out things like computers and television sets and whatever? Is this the work of Marx's toilers? Not at all. The fact that labor has the ability to produce what it does physically is the result primarily of the businessmen and capitalists. They are raising real wages by reducing the quantity of labor needed to produce goods and improving the quality of those goods, and they're responsible for the payment of the money wages the workers receive and for making those wages stand in a larger share relative to consumption. Okay, I think perhaps this is a logical stopping point. I want to give you some opportunity for questions. So we can mop up remaining productive functions tomorrow and go into further material. Let's draw a line for the time being and open the floor to questions. Thank you. The gentleman over on my left.
How much of the value directly of intelligence is in itself considered labor? Doesn't the businessman have to manage labor mentally to formulate an idea for making money and the labor that he's managing?
I'm sorry, I don't quite hear the last part. Just repeat the question.
Yes. How much of the guiding directly intelligence is in itself considered labor? Doesn't the businessman have to labor mentally to formulate an idea? Making money and labor
that implement. You're asking how much of the businessman's guiding directing intelligence is labor? Doesn't he have to labor mentally in order to produce the product? He does have to labor primarily mentally, not exclusively, but that's the essential activity of a businessman, usually, certainly a larger scale businessman. And that's his labor. Labor is not simply moving physical objects. The labor is also all of the thinking. More fundamentally, it's the thinking behind it. Marx, that doesn't enter into Marx's view of things. I don't think it's an accident that Marx was concerned with the material productive forces. There isn't much room for intelligence. You see, don't get the idea that Marx had this theory before him, and how did he answer it? He never heard such a thing. Dr. Binswanger.
I think the net consumption theory is a terrific achievement, and I want to ask if I get it. Implication of it. What you're really saying is that the source of profits is the yachts bought by Catholics in profits in the monetary sense in aggregate, does this mean that there's a kind of self-correcting mechanism if too few capitalists start to consume their profits rather than reinvest them, that the fact that the rate of profits would then go up would serve as a magnet to start drawing them back in the opposite direction?
Okay, you're saying, I thank you for your remark about it being an achievement. I appreciate that. You're saying that I'm saying that, in effect, the yachts bought by the capitalists are the source of profits. I have to make some major qualifications to that. First, let me remind you, I haven't finished the theory of profit. There's another major source of profits, too. And when we say that it's the consumption of the capitalists that are responsible for profits, bear in mind, we're talking in the context of the economy as a whole. Do not think that the consumption of an individual capitalist could ever be responsible for his profits. The question might arise, I'm surprised someone, well, I've only asked a couple of people, but someone must have it in the back of his mind, is what I'm saying implying that a good way to raise your profits would be to raise your dividend, go out and consume the money, and then you'll have a higher profit? No, that would not help you as an individual businessman. Let me try to illustrate the principle. Imagine in the economy as a whole, net consumption, NC, is 200, and capital is 2,000. So the rate of profit is 10%. And now let's assume we have an individual business firm, which would be quite sizable relative to the whole economy. Its capital is 10, and up to now, its owners have been consuming 1. They're also consuming at the rate of 10%. Now let's ask, what would happen if these guys say, I heard an interesting lecture down in San Diego. Now I know how to raise our profits. We are going to transfer 1 unit of our capital. We'll reduce our capital to 9, and we'll consume 2. Will we then raise our rate of profit from 10% to 2/9? No. What would happen is they would increase net consumption in the whole economy to 201. Capital in the whole economy would be 1999. Their capital would now be 9 over 1999 time, and their profit would be that times 201. If you take, you see, they have a smaller share of the capital in the economy. They are reducing their capital by 10%. They're adding to the profits of the whole economy by 0.5%. They will end up making approximately 10% less profit. If you take the trouble to divide, to work this out, 9/1999 times 201 is less than 1 over 10. Initially, they had 10 of the whole capital over 2,000, and their profit was that times 200. 10/200, they had 1/200 of the capital of the economy, they made 1/200 of the profit, assuming they had average efficiency. Now they have significantly less than 1/200. They have 9/1999, that's about only 90% of 1/200. And profits are increased very modestly. If you multiply this out, their profit, instead of being 1, would be 9/10. No individual business firm is in a position to increase its profits by raising its consumption. Now what happens, there is a tendency for the lowest rates of net consumption among individual businessmen to dictate the overall average rate. Imagine that we have different individual firms. In some cases, the businessmen are consuming at a rate equal to 15% of their capital. In other business firms, they're consuming at a rate equal to 5% of their capital. The overall economy-wide average is 10%, and the rate of profit is 10%. What happens to those firms whose consumption rate exceeds the overall economy-wide average? What happens to an individual firm whose dividend is equal to 15% of its capital, whose rate of profit is equal to 10% of its capital? They will deplete their capital. What happens to the business firm which consumes at a rate equal to 5% of its capital while earning a 10% rate? They will expand their capital. If they continued indefinitely to consume at 5%, all of the capital gravitates to the firms with the lowest rates of net consumption. Now, there's more to your question. Yeah.
My question was based on an example in the handout where you just held one figure over here on page 8.
Yeah, on page 8. Right.
And all I was observing, I realized fully that it wouldn't work for an individual, but if there was some change in the philosophy or something towards more hedonism, all I'm saying is that as they start consuming more, the rate of profit in the economy goes up, which is then a motivation for them to not go any further or go back towards...
Okay. You're saying if the rate of net consumption and rate of profit rose, would the higher rate of profit now act as an incentive to a higher rate of saving? There are individual cases where I could imagine it doing that, but by and large, I think that the rate of saving is not determined by the rate of profit. The rate of profit does not provide an incentive to save. Now, you could say on the one hand, all right, if the rate of profit is higher, for every $100 I save, I'll have that much more next year. That's true. But to whatever extent you already have savings, what happens to your need for additional savings? Let's imagine you had $1 million, and initially you're making a 10% annual rate of return. So you can look forward to $100,000 a year income. All right, now suppose the rate of return would be 15%. And we want to consider the question, should I save an extra $1,000? Because now instead of having an extra $1,100 next year, I can have an extra $1,150. Well, how important will be that extra $1,150 to you next year, given the fact that your income next year, instead of being $100,000, is already going to be $150,000? See, this cuts both ways. Let me come at it this way. Suppose you could expect to coming into an inheritance next year. You'd be better off next year. How would that affect your consumption this year? You would probably consume more. Now, if there's a higher rate of profit, on the one side, each dollar saved will give you that much more in the future. But on the other side, to whatever extent you were saving anyway, you're going to have that much more in the future. So it may be that the rate of profit itself might be neutral with regard to saving, and people do not save more or less in response to the rate of profit. You see, what is true, if there's any individual industry that offers a higher rate of profit than other industries, that's where capital is going to go. But if the rate of profit in the economy as a whole is higher, it does not necessarily follow that saving will be higher on an incentive basis. Mr. Valiant.
You said earlier that a lot of your thinking in this area was inspired by some arguments you had with other Austrians. And I wonder, given the vicinity of your explanation, what the resistance is.
I can't find them to confront them with an argument. I submitted a paper with moral qualms to the Journal of Austrian Economics explaining why there was no tendency toward a fall in the rate of profit. And it was rejected twice. I would love to debate them. But I don't think I'll have a very easy chance getting the opportunity. Mrs. Lieneman. Okay, thank you. I appreciate this question. Why am I leaving out opportunity cost? Is that because it's more micro rather than macro? I'll have to explain briefly to most members of the audience what is meant by opportunity cost. This is a very popular doctrine in economics, which says your costs are not merely the money that you spend, they are also the monetary value of foregone opportunities. A typical example would be, and this is, if I had an extra couple of minutes, I'd find you a quotation. A typical example would be, here's a hardware store owner. His accountant does his books, and he tells him, you had a good year, Joe. You made a $30,000 profit. And now there's an author of an economics textbook who jumps in and says, very foolish. These guys don't know economics. Have you stopped to consider that if you took the capital invested in your hardware store and put it in the bank instead, you might make $15,000 a year interest? Have you considered that if you went to work for someone else, you might make $20,000 a year in wages? So you see, you haven't made a $30,000 profit at all. You've made a $5,000 loss. This is the way the economics profession treats costs. Now, the opportunity cost doctrine is incompatible with the theory of profit that I'm propounding. And when I realized that, I began to look for what is wrong with the opportunity cost doctrine. Now, I have to, so that those of you who know economics won't think I'm ignorant of some important areas of the subject, let me say that I recognize very fully, as you should realize I do if you've read The Government Against the Economy, that the price of a raw material, let us say, is influenced by the value it has in all different possible uses. The price you pay for gasoline is influenced by the intensity of people's need and desire for heating oil. All of these things feed into the price of crude oil, which then feeds back to the price of gasoline. So it's certainly true that what we pay for something reflects its importance in all kinds of alternative uses. But there's one very critical element that we should never forget. We're talking about all of these things being focused in a money price. There is a money price of crude oil, which reflects the importance of all the different oil products, but there's a money price. Now, the opportunity cost doctrine doesn't think that the actual payment of a money price is of any significance, and it thinks it is just as much a cost, even though you never paid an actual sum of money, the fact that you could have earned wages which you didn't earn and could have earned interest that you didn't earn, and it treats that as a cost. Now, let's examine this doctrine. Let's imagine our hardware store owner, he's told he's got a $5,000 loss. Well, that will come as a surprise to him because during the year, he's consumed $20,000 and he's increased his net worth by $10,000. Now, if he had a $5,000 loss in the real world and consumed $20,000, his net worth would have had to decline by $25,000. But it's up by $10,000. Well, how do we reconcile this difference? Well, now the economists who would support this doctrine will say, well, what we're going to do is say that this man, instead of earning the $30,000 profit his accountant tells him he earned, he's earned the $20,000 of wages that he didn't earn and the $15,000 of interest that he didn't earn. So he's earned $20,000 wages, $15,000 interest, and has a $5,000 loss. And that reconciles it. Now we've introduced fictional incomes to offset a fictional loss, the very incomes his failure of which to earn creates the initial problem. We're not finished yet. There's more. Imagine a man marries a very good-looking woman, but he might have married a beautiful woman. He has a loss. Well, how do we explain the fact that she's beautiful, that she's very good looking? She's had plastic surgery. Or I gained 10 pounds, but I might have gained 20 pounds. I've lost 10. Unfortunately, a mysterious tailor has taken my clothes in. And there are other things. General Electric has a research department. They come up with two great products, one of which can earn a 40% rate of profit, the other can earn a 39% rate of profit. What's their profit with the opportunity cost? Only 1%. How do you raise your profits? Reduce your alternative opportunities. And then the other side, let me point out, this connects with an issue that was raised by someone in lecture one. What if you buy, you install your own light bulb and you save the cost of employing someone? The other side to the opportunity cost doctrine is saying the absence of an income is a cost. The absence of an income you might have earned is a cost. The other error is to say the saving of an expense is an income. And that is also rife throughout economics. This is called the doctrine of imputed income. And it comes up, you might find it in this way. There are people who say, well, what's a wife worth? Think of all the money the average husband saves by virtue of having a wife who cleans the house and so on. And there are studies done every so often applying the wage rates of cooks, housekeepers, chauffeurs, governesses, on and on, to the number of hours spent by the average housewife in doing all these tasks. And they say, the national income statistics are all wet. They're leaving out billions and billions of dollars of services performed by housewives. And this is an imputed income. It's a saving of an expense, and they want to treat it as an income. Well, we'd have to raise the question, if we have a housewife who's earning $30,000 a year in an imputed income, where is she getting the money? Who pays it to her? How would you treat the books? Here's a family that has now $30,000 more income than it thought it had. Where did it go? Well, the accounting treatment to incorporate such a thing into the national income accounts would be to say the wife turns her fictional earnings over to her husband so he can buy them, her services from her. She's supporting him even though she's not working. And in this way, bring the housewife into the national income picture. Now, interestingly, there are studies that are done to come up with the figures. For some reason, they all studiously ignore the value of the wife's sexual services. That would inflate the imputed income a lot more. And then the average husband would be living off the earnings of prostitution. And we'd have sexual intercourse as the leading item in the index of industrial production. So the moral of this, for these reasons, I once wrote an article called Cost and Revenue, an Economist's Defense of the Accounting Concepts. So I think economics has something of value to learn from the way ordinary business accounting is carried on. Now, I think we're pressing the time limit a little bit. I've still got tomorrow and Saturday, and I'm going to have a special session Wednesday. So let me ask you to defer your questions till then. Thank you very much.